Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout. And today I'm the one who's talked to all the writers. So here we go. Siobhan Harvey is a remarkable poet and creative nonfiction writer. And she's written her memoir, a memoir that has already garnered prizes and awards. I'm then talking to Owen Marshall, the master, about a new book of poetry, and with scientist Carolyn King about an interesting life documenting the lives of weasels and stoats. But first up, we're going to be talking from Claudia from Scorpio, our wonderful sponsors, about what's coming up in the store this month. Here we go with our monthly catch-up with Claudia from our sponsors, Scorpio, the best bookshop, I think, in the world, the galaxy, the universe. And Claudia is going to tell us what events are coming up in July. And, of course, midwinter, guilt-free reading, I've decided, because, yeah, you're not going to feel like you should be outside doing something.
That's right. Yeah, I went outside today and I learned my lesson. I've got very weak legs as a result. We have two launches in the shop in July, and then there's this magical event happening where all of the booksellers of the country all go away and squirrel away together later on. So we're just keeping it down to two launches for us. On Tuesday the 7th of July in the shop, we have the launch of a new edition of Happy Moments by Len Lai, the Christchurch artist. This event coincides with the 125th anniversary of Lai's birth in Christchurch. Len will not be present.
No, I was going to make that obvious comment.
Just in case that's not clear. This particular book, Happy Moments, was initially published posthumously in 2002. But it was actually written by Len in the 1960s, and it features it's a memoir, and it features essays on his ideas and drawings that he himself has done. And then this new edition, edited by Roger Horrocks, there's going to be a little tour of the country held by the Len Lai Foundation. So they will be hosting this event with us at Scorpio on 7th of July. It's a wonderful book. The trustees are going to speak to the legacy of the artist, and it's been described as a colourful account of his early years. I believe that Lai was quite uninhibited when it came to discussing what he was thinking about on the page, and I think that the books are the more interesting for it. It's going to cover some intense experiences, including his childhood years at the Cape Campbell Lighthouse and his passion for drawing. The poet Alistair Reid described the book as beautifully transparent and heart-stopping. So it sounds like it's going to be quite a shaker of a book. And I know it's a new edition, but if you try and find editions of the earlier published version, you'll see that they'll set you back quite a lot of money. I think the first run in the early noughties was quite selective, or rather, should I say, quite select. So we're looking forward to this reissue. It's going to come out in a slightly more budget-friendly format. And we encourage you all to come along and to join the celebration for the 125th anniversary of Len's birthday. He did, of course, grow up in Christchurch, so we get quite protective about artists down here, don't we? They tend to sort of pass through.
Yes, but if we've got a link with them, we're going to make the most of it. And he was an extraordinary, you know, internationally acclaimed artist. So we can be proud of him.
Indeed. So that should be a lot of fun. Now, completely different, you know, couldn't be. I'd be interested to know if anyone can find the link between these two events. But Tuesday, the 21st of July, we are going to be hosting the launch of Dogs of the World by Craig Turner Bullock. Another book that celebrates art, I suppose there's a link. Craig is famous for his photography of dogs. You may have heard of his earlier works, Quake Dogs, Quake Cats, and A Dog's Life. I believe some of the Scorpio dogs may even have been photographed by Craig for previous publications, which is quite interesting. Craig's done a photography book. It's large format, it's heavy, with just nothing but the idea of wandering the globe and taking photos of dogs in different locations all around the world. So, for example, the front cover has a French bulldog in front of the little glass pyramid of the Louvre, you know, sticking out of the
IMP, famous glass pyramids.
That's right. So this should be a lot of fun. It's going to be quirky. I believe Craig is bringing his dogs in as well. And we think it's going to just be a great night in the bookshop. So come along and join us on the 21st of July.
Well, I'm happy to say I've just got a copy of the book and I have passed it over to my my right-hand woman person. Let's get this politically correct. Marianne, because she's a great dog lover, so she will be doing an interview with Craig later on. But boy, is it a sumptuous book. I have one query. I have one, is that in the terrier section, he has not got a photo of a Jack Russell, and I can't believe you could have a terrier section and leave out the famous Jack Russell. But I won't be here, unfortunately, to take that up with Craig. But all the other, I have nothing but praise for it. So
he would have been sweating if you'd barreled up to him at the launch and gone,
exactly. Exactly. He's been spared that. And unfortunately I will be in Melbourne with cats rather than dogs. I am a dog fancier, absolutely. Mm. So have a wonderful month, and I hope those two very different but very very colourful. They're both sort of high powered launches, really, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so. Quite out there. Good for the scene.
Absolutely, and you enjoy your bookshop getaway. Publishers, bookshops.
Sales conference of 2026 should be quite interesting.
Yes, a lot of good things come out of that, Claudia.
Yes, they do. Yeah.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
What We Remember, What We Forget, A Memoir in Memory, is the latest work by Auckland poet, creative writing lecturer, essayist, and a very talented person all round, Siobhan Harvey. I've talked to Siobhan before about her poetry, and she has been recognised for this by numerous awards. Would probably take me quite a bit of this interview to go through them, but she has been given the Kathleen Grattan Poetry Award. She was longlisted for the Ockham New Zealand Book Awards, and in 2021, the Janet Frame Literary Trust Award for Poetry, and again, Robert Burns Poetry Prize. This memoir has already garnered praise and accolades. It was the category winner in the 2025 Memoir Prize for Books, an American prize, and was also highly commended for the Bridport Memoir Award, which is based in the UK. Siobhan, that recognition for the quality of the work must have given you an enormous amount of pride, but also confidence in putting this work out.
It gave me a lot of support as well. Beyond the pride, there is the support that the prizes offer. For instance, with the Bridport Prize, it is a segmented award. So effectively, you submit a piece of your memoir, and then that gets looked at by a range of judges and internationally recognised agents. And then you find out whether you've been longlisted or not. And then you go through, again, another judging process to shortlisting and then to selection. So that gave me the support to actually keep going with the development of the work, as well as just the validation that actually there was something there that was worth pursuing and being and having and finding recognition in.
Because it is a very heart-rending book to read. It's quite a visceral process that the reader goes through. So I can only imagine what it was like for you to write this story. But expand a little on a memoir in memory, what you are talking about there.
Well, I think the whole point of a memoir is that it's based in memory. That's what we know. And our memories are not set in stone. They are a fragile terrain in which the understanding of ourselves relies purely within that fragility. The knowing that, for instance, two people can experience the same things and yet come out with two different stories. And I thought there was something very rich and fecund in that process, whilst holding on to knowing that this is my truth. I know these things happen to me. I experience them. And in that, there is a sense in which one explores one's rich life and one's past through the lens of that truth of identity and self, whilst simultaneously grappling with how one looks at that in the unreliable soil of remembrance. And I think those components are what I'm grappling with in the book, that there is a truth that is my truth, and yet that truth is something which is sometimes very difficult to hold on to, very difficult to return to. And those are emotional and sentient things, not just memorial things. So part of the book is obviously about a memory that the book opens up with, a memory that I don't have, an experience that I was told about, that was a memory that was gifted to me by someone that raised me, which was an overdose experience. I don't doubt it happened, but in its happening, why do I not remember it? And that was a provocation. And what unfolded thereafter was a series of understandings around memories that I hold, memories that I did witness, and what they mean to me in the returning to them, the re-inhabitation of them, the re-exploration of them, and the coming within that kind of complex engagement with the memory to some sort of settlement. How can we come to a place in which we both accept the fragility of memory and the certainty of our existence, which is framed through our past and our memory, and find some solace in that, as hard as that may be?
Well, I imagine you have been through a lot of this material in writing poetry. It, you know, was a fertile ground for that, and in doing that, you would have been not laying the ghosts to rest, because that isn't as simple as that, but, you know, coming to a degree of understanding and and, you know, resolution. But this kind of exercise of laying it down in prose on paper, wherever it started, tell me about that as a different experience from having written poems.
Yes, I mean, partly I have explored some of these issues, although not all of them, not the wide scope of what is found here, through poetry. And I think that's entirely a comfortable process in terms of the fact that the experiences that one has can exist both in many different written forms. That's fine. And one can explore an experience through poetry and then still explore it through nonfiction, through the memoir. I think what I understood in this engagement with nonfiction is the first premise, which is that when I'm writing poetry, there's a sense of the prose and the fictional behind that. One can say to oneself, unto one's audience, well, this is a fiction, this is poetry. Yes, it's based on my experiences, but I have placed it within the lens of the fictional. There is no escaping the vulnerability of saying to the reader in nonfiction, this is me, this is what happened, this is what I experienced. And so that is a weight that one has to bear as a writer. But I also think there's something that is liberating in that, which is that one understands that one is also embracing the poet in one is embracing the storyteller in one. This book took the better part of 15 years to write. The first pieces that I laid, that I wrote and completed, for instance, I think it's the third chapter, I wrote back in 2011 and was shortly, I was runner-up in the Landfall essay competition back then. A second piece, which is about our son's journey through school, I wrote at the same time that I wrote Cloud Boy back in 2014, and that was also highly commended in the Landfall essay competition. So there is a long whakapapa to the development of this, and a synchronicity in which I was writing all forms of my writings at the same time as writing this memoir. What I understood in that conjunction of both writing the nonfiction and the poetry is that the liberation was found in embracing the multiplicity of that which makes up story. I read, as I was developing these pieces, a wonderful collection of memoir by Mary Oliver, who is an esteemed poet, called Upstream. And it taught me so much about how we can frame our own lives and own our own lives and the vulnerability of that and anchor it to a wider storytelling process that is poetic and is composed of those things that are structural in the storytelling process and are character-driven and so forth. So the combination of these things helped me to see that what I was writing was, yes, very vulnerable and exposing. I am exposing myself to the reader and I am offering the reader into my lives in a way that I wasn't doing in poetry. And yet, as a writer, there was immense ability to immerse myself in a craft, an incremental development, a realizing of a life that I could take some form of sustenance and succor from.
Yeah, I think your writing has been absolutely critical to your making sense, especially of your childhood, you distance yourself from the people that you lived with, and you need to, because, you know, you can't really call them parents. They didn't earn that title. So if, you know, if writing had not been available to you, it would have been difficult for you to, you know,
yes,
live your life after that.
Yeah, and I've only ever known myself as a writer, and I have to write. I don't know why. Well, I didn't ever know why that was. I grew up in, you know, a violent household of uneducated or poorly educated people who raised me in a very insular, phobic community that had been very roughly treated by economic and political conditions at the time. And I was writing, and I didn't understand why that was. The journey of the memoir has helped me to understand it, because it's also been the journey of unearthing my own whakapapa and finding this writer in there. But I just wanted to underscore one thing about what you were saying, which I think is wonderful, in terms of my engagement and my distancing from those people that raised me. What I also realized in the completion or the writing of the memoir was that this is my life, and that these are my experiences, and that these are my truths, and that I don't owe the people that raised me much. But the one thing that I owe everybody that I write about is anonymity, that they made the decisions they made that impacted the life that I have lived and the way that I've had to live my life, and the reasons and the development of my life since my engagement with them. And I am placing myself, and I'm opening myself up to the reader, and I'm offering my truth to the reader. But they did not choose to be included openly in that story. And that if I had a right in any way to embrace them into the story, I also had a responsibility to ensure that they could at least be afforded their anonymity.
Mm.
And so what I consciously do with the memoir is that I give anonymity to everybody but me in that memoir. I have changed the names of the people that raised me, and I've given them a marker rather than names. I have consciously called them Mr. and Mrs. Y, because to me, I have questions, lots of questions about the decisions that they make, and lots of doubt still about the why they chose to raise a child in the way that they did. And so that's the why questions that remain. But the Mr. and Mrs. Y also gives them the anonymity that I think, if I owe them nothing else, and I don't, I do at least owe them the right not to be known, not to be found out about, not to be located by anybody else outside of this story.
Yeah, I understand all those reasons, and it's interesting because memoir raises, anybody's memoir raises all those questions. Just to finish, Siobhan, I have to say this, that having read Cloud Boy and knowing something of the difficulty, or the, well, difficulties, that's a bit of a euphemism, some of the treatment that your son went through as a boy in the educational system, and how you and your partner were treated as well, it was such a wonderful thing to realise that he has survived, he has thrived now, and that he, you know, really has provided you with a way of not pardoning or of the people who mistreated him, but of your being able to let some of that go.
Yes, and that's how the latter half of the chapter really, at the latter half of the book, engages with and resolves itself. The reality is that the solace that I can find in it, the great strength that I can find in it, is in the act of parenthood and of fighting for him, but also, and it is a deeply fraught and tender engagement, which is that we're given a child, we raise a child, we try our best to fight and defend and provide the best parenting that we can to a child, and the child gives back to us and makes us the better person. The letting go of that, which no one ever tells you when this child is placed in your arm, you have to navigate alone. But he has given so much back to us. And one of the things that the memoir realises, and one of the things that I realise, is that in his journey and in his growth to be the amazing adult that he is, he has found the liberation and the comfort and the settlement and the wonder that has nourished me as his mother to see him do all these things. He's currently doing his postgraduate studies. He's read this work and gave me the legitimacy, which I think is part of the memoir process, to say, yes, it's fine for you to publish this. I'm very proud of it. And he's now doing wonderful things in the world. And I think that's where the memory rests, is my realisation that all the hardships that I have been through have all resulted in him. And he's in an amazingly positive space. And that is something I have to embrace and do embrace and find great, great sustenance and nurture in.
Well, thank you for telling your story. It's a simplistic thing to say, but it is a story. It's a story well worth reading, and you will be greatly rewarded for it. It's called What We Remember, What We Forget. It's by Siobhan Harvey, and it's published by Otago University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Mastery. There is a thin kid who cycles past our house on school days with shirt out, socks down, a small backpack, none of which makes him at all unusual. What strikes me is how fast he pedals, yet sits upright in the sunlight with folded arms, supremely confident that the bike intuits his intention and accepts his command. It seems not a conscious display, but for him a normal means of progress. Both the skill and audacity impress me. And I imagine that he will become a pilot, steeplejack, astronaut, or trapeze artist. But maybe he's good with figures too, and will study well to become accomplished in accounts with an expensive limousine rather than a bike.
Owen Marshall, reading from his latest collection of poetry, Beyond the Border. I think this is your fifth, Owen, is that right?
It is, and I think there's a nice synchronicity in that my first book of poems in 2004 was published by Quentin Wilson at Hazard Press, and so Quentin has also published this one, so I'm pleased about that.
Well, of course, we know you as a much-loved, awarded and acknowledged novelist, short story writer, essayist, and this collection has been described as displaying wisdom, subtlety, and wit. All those characteristics, I think, are part of what we know of you as a writer generally anyway. So it's another genre for you to display all this wisdom, subtlety, and wit, isn't it?
Well, kind comment. Must have been some friend that said that.
Oh, sure.
I've always enjoyed reading poetry. My father was very keen on poetry, read to us, wrote some poetry and had it published himself. But earlier in my career, I was exclusively a writer of prose fiction. And it was only later, when I became a professional writer, that I thought perhaps I would try to extend myself into another genre and try poetry. So it came comparatively late in my writing career, but I've enjoyed it. And one of the interesting things I noticed in doing that was that there was quite a difference in the creative process between the prose and the poetry. I can't will poems in the way that I can will the fiction. The poems choose the time themselves that they wish to come. And I found that quite an interesting difference in the process of writing poetry.
So you have to catch them when they come.
Yes, I can't just sit down and say, I'm going to write two poems before lunch. whereas I can say, right, I want to get so many lines done in this novel or in this short story. So, it's just interesting that they tend to choose their own time to visit me.
A lot of your poems are wonderfully, I would call them whimsical as well as witty, because, you know, in this collection you've got poems to A Discarded Coat, to Keys, Apologies for Past Misdemeanors, postcards in a sense from travels, poems towards that comment on your love of sitting in the sun, something I have in common with you.
Yes, well, I suppose, more of my life is now behind me than before, and I suppose there's a reflective, almost elegiac quality to some of these poems. The quote that I use from Rainer Rilke at the beginning of the book is, "Poetry is the past that breaks out in our hearts," and I think that's for me, very, very true at this time of my life. And it doesn't mean to say that they have to be melancholic poems, but they are reflective and often quite backward-looking.
Well, you're right. At this stage of our life, there's a lot, lot of time that we reflect on how we've come to be the way we are. And, that's the joy of reading poetry, isn't it? That it provokes in you, the reader, memories of your own and thoughts of your own.
Yes, I think that's true. I think poetry is perhaps the most idiosyncratic and subjective of literary forms, and I suppose all the more fascinating for that. Poetry has many faces, and different writers favour different expressions. I value technical virtuosity, imaginative reach, personal sincerity, but I suppose most of all I respond to emotional power. That's what interests me in the poetry I read, and I suppose it's what I try to express in the poetry that I write.
Do you spend, I'm sure you do, because I'm sure you did this, you do the same with your prose, but is there a lot of time taken up with drafting and redrafting and editing?
I find that that my poetry is probably more personal than my prose. I'm not quite sure why that is, but I tend to probably reveal more of myself and my own experience and my own life in the poetry than I do in the prose. I don't know whether other writers find that to be the case. And there is a good deal of work has to go into forming a poem from the idea that comes to you. And so you do go over it quite a few times. Because it's a shorter form of writing, you do want to have it the very best that you can achieve. So there's a good deal of burnishing does go on in poetry. Doesn't mean to say that a good editor can't still be of considerable assistance. And I'd like to mention Anna Rogers here, perhaps, who edited my collection, and I very much appreciated her input.
Yes, you've worked over many books with Anna, so she would be able to be quite forthright, but also, you know, have a deep understanding of what it is that you do and how you do it.
Yes, I've found her expertise and encouragement over many years to be very beneficial.
Poetry, too, you know, it's interesting, isn't it? I remember talking with C.K. Stead about his poetry, and for him, I remember he thought that, you know, it, of all the genres that he worked in, poetry was the one that he obviously wanted to be the best at, in a sense.
Right. And he is a very, very good poet. I actually think his poetry is even stronger than his prose, but he has certainly some very fine poems. And someone else who has influenced me considerably, Vincent O'Sullivan, who unfortunately now has passed away, but another very fine poet, and someone who was very supportive and encouraging for me.
Yes. Was it a difficult no, obviously you wanted to write poetry, and if you want to, you will. But was there a hesitation about first coming out as a poet, I suppose?
Well, I suppose, you know, sometimes if you're only interested in getting published or perhaps in making money, you just persist with the things that you're being successful with. But I think most serious writers, they want to challenge themselves. They want to extend their capability in various forms of writing. So I did reach the stage in which I thought, I enjoy reading poetry, and I challenge myself to write some poetry. And of course, there's a learning process within that. But I think most writers do want to challenge themselves rather than just repeating themselves.
Yes, and that is, they can do that by tackling different genres, can't they? And, you know, in a sense, you talk about your poetry as revealing more of yourself, in your memories and your in thinking about your past. Is it a kind of a form of memoir in a sense? You're putting down your thoughts and memories and stories.
I think that's true, Maureen. I mean, I've been lucky in that my writing has enabled me to travel quite extensively. It's taken me to Antarctica, it's taken me to China, it's taken me to Norfolk Island, it's taken me several times to Europe. And yes, in poetry, I do like to revisit those places and to capture something of them in the poetry. I think that personal experience can be very important in your life, and also poetry is a way of of reflecting on it and perhaps making it more permanent in your mind and perhaps the mind of others.
Yeah, it's a distilled, wonderful distilled image or memory or fragment or whatever, isn't it?
It is, yes. I think that they're little sort of starlights, aren't they, in your own recollection.
Yes. There was one of your, I don't know why I noted this down, it's obviously my sense of humour as well as yours. There's a poem where you come across your first car, not your actual first car, but the first car that you had, and you remark that bums must have been smaller then when you look at the little chair seats that are in the car. There's a lot of wonderful asides like that in your poems. Yes.
Well, I think most of us, when you think of those little Lee Austin 7s and Morris 8s and so on, you know, when you see them now, they do look very, very small, don't they?
They do,
yes. But however, we were always very proud to own one at the time.
We were, and it gave us a huge amount of freedom. Owen, I would love you to read us a poem to end this interview, and let me say it's a lovely collection of poems.
Thank you, Maureen, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to be on the program. I appreciate it. Perhaps I'll read then finally a poem called Snow at Christmas, and this also is a reflective poem, and many years ago, in fact, it did snow on Christmas Day when we lived in Oamaru. So here's a poem, Snow at Christmas. I recall few individual Christmases, for they swarm happily together in bright festoon of presents, cards, crackers, cake and children. But one year in Oamaru, it snowed on Christmas Day, and the seasonal paradox froze that one time in memory. My wife's aunt and uncle were with her, wearing party hats, and he with his sleeves half rolled up as farmers do. We stood by the big window and looked down to the sea. The bronze fire surround caught the light. The chairs and sofa were aglow with the heaped and crumpled colours of festive paper, and my daughter had both small hands spread on the window sill as she watched the snow fall, soft and slow. An anomaly, of course, and it was over soon, melted as it touched the ground. But it snowed in Oamaru on Christmas Day that year long ago, and I am there with family, standing at the window to see it fall.
Owen Marshall's new collection of poems is called Beyond the Border, and it's published by Quentin Wilson Publishing.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Totally Fascinated is a memoir of a lifetime study of weasels and stoats. It's written by Professor Emerita Carolyn King, who now lives, I think, in Kirikiriroa, Hamilton, but grew up in England. She did her training there. She got a doctorate at Oxford University on the field ecology of native weasels. And then in 1971, she was offered a job with the DSIR. She's been here ever since, and she has looked at her professional life, trying to understand the extraordinary lives of these mustelids, but also her personal life as well. Carolyn, you have had a fascinating life. both, you know, your childhood in England, your training there, and then coming here and being part of such an important scientific line of research. You had, I think, a number of journals and notes and letters, a lot of material that you could use to put this memoir together.
I did, yes.
And what was it that made you decide that it would be more than just a family record?
Oh, well, you remember the lockdown that we had in the days of COVID, and there was me stuck at home. I wasn't able to pursue my normal activities, but I did have a large blue cabin trunk that I had brought around the world with me, with a great deal of the information that relates to what I used to be doing before I came to New Zealand, and indeed what I have done since then. So because I couldn't actually do what I had been planning to do, I spent that time during the lockdown fishing through my cabin trunk and deciding that what was there was actually worth talking about. So that's how the whole project that's totally fascinated began. And I wouldn't have dreamed of trying to publish it, except that I also met a chap called Quentin Wilson, who runs his own publishing firm down in Christchurch. And I was talking to him, and he said, "This sounds really fascinating. I'd love to do a book about this." And that's where it all began. So I was, it wasn't that I actually made it happen. I was lucky enough to meet people who could make it happen.
You've written extensively over the years. You've written books about stoats and weasels. I think, you know, the definitive book about New Zealand mustelids called Immigrant Killers. So was it different this time, putting...
Oh, well, yeah, that was a long time ago. That came out in 1984, and that was when I was just starting. I had to leave my job with DSAR because they had these peculiar ideas about maternity leave. You either have to go back to full-time work when your baby is 6 months old, or else you resign. Those were the only two options offered. And I didn't want to resign, but neither did I want to leave my son full-time at that tender age. And so I chose to resign, and I spent a lot of the work that is described in my publications at home. We had a very beautiful house on the hills in Des Bay, overlooking the harbour, and I spent a lot of time there pulling it all together. I was fortunate that I had a very tolerant and supportive husband who didn't mind me disappearing off into the back bedroom every evening. And that's where it all began, yeah.
Well, you had to overcome, a judgment that was made about you and your intellect very early on in your childhood that could have been a damning, it was damning, but it could have had a really negative effect on how you saw yourself and what you could aspire to.
Yes, it did. I was at a village primary school in England, and there was one of these I think she was probably of the generation who missed out on husbands after the war because there were so few men left then, and it made her very negative. And certainly I was something of a slow developer, but I don't know that I actually deserved being told that I was the most unsatisfactory pupil the school had ever had. But I put that aside and carried on doing what I wanted to do anyway.
And you had the tragedy of your parents dying when you were just a young teenager. And that's terrible, but you had two older sisters who who spent a lot of time caring for you.
Yes, then. Absolutely. It was enormous blessing for me and a hard luck for them, but they had to, or they felt they had to, put whatever they were planning to do aside for a few years while they got me through school, at least as far as sixth form. And if they hadn't done that and it hadn't enabled me to qualify to go to university when I was 18, that was Liverpool University, none of the rest of my life would have been the same. So I owe everything I am or ever will be to them.
Well, you rewarded them richly by going on from Liverpool to do your doctorate at Oxford.
Yes, yes, I did. I didn't think of it like that, but that was the effect because the whole feeling then is, I mean, I'm looking back on it now. I don't know that I felt this at the time. But now I look back on it and I say, well, what could I do to compensate them or repay them for what they did for me? Because, I mean, the school leaving age in those days was 15. They could have waited till I got that far and then thrown me out and said, okay, you're on your own now, find a job. They didn't do that. They supported me right through to the sixth form, and that made it possible for me to go to university and everything that followed from there. So I owe everything I ever became to them. And I'm still enormously, consciously grateful to both of them.
Where did your love of weasels and stoats come from? I know you were a very keen outdoorsy person. You loved horses. You loved getting out into the countryside.
Yeah. Yeah, when I finished at Liverpool with a respectable BSc, I didn't actually know what to do. But what happened, to my great relief, was that I met a guy who suggested that I should go to the Bureau of Animal Population, which was a special research project organisation founded by Charles Elton, and say, hi guys, I'm here. I don't have any ideas. What should I do? And my supervisor said, well, most people in this research group work in a field study area, which is only 4 miles outside Oxford. He said, if you haven't got a clue what to do next, you should go up to the wood and talk to the gamekeeper up there and ask him what were the options. So I went up there and I asked him, and he said, well, there are wood mice, and there are bank voles, and there are and he checked off all the animals that lived in the area, and they were all inappropriate for various reasons. And then finally, he said there are a few weasels, and I'd actually at that point never seen one. I went back to my supervisor, and I was instantly attracted by the idea. I said to him, I want to work on weasels. And he said, don't do that because there aren't enough of them to make a respectable thesis. But with any luck, with the luck that seems to follow me, I did actually manage to make a thesis out of it. And even better fortune was that my supervisor, his name is Mick Southern, knew the guy who then eventually left Oxford for New Zealand and established a similar research base of his own. And he said, well, when you've finished your PhD, you can go down there and ask him what he would like to do, you to do. So I did that, and that's where it all began.
Now, I grew up on a farm in the Waikato, and I have to insert my father's joke here because for some reason it always made me laugh, but he used to always say you can weasley tell a weasel because a stoat's totally different. And I'm sure that's a joke you've heard far too many times. But
I wouldn't mind a dollar for every time I've heard it. Yeah.
But they're such elusive animals, aren't they? I don't know whether I've seen a weasel or a stoat, but I have sort of seen one or the other just briefly over my life.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, they are beautiful animals in their own right. And I've always loved them for their willowy grace and their absolutely superb capability of being what they are meant to be, which is to be an absolutely thoughtless predator of small mammals. And in their own home country in England, that's entirely appropriate because it's part of the natural scene. The difficulty is when they were brought here to New Zealand, because as well as mice and voles, they also kill rabbits. And in the 1800s, down in Otago, there were many, 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 many rabbits that were eating all the grass that was intended for the sheep. And so the landholders looked around and said, "We've got too many rabbits. What do we do about that?" The answer is not enough predators. So they sent to England and they organised 10 years of continual introductions, shipments, and I've written up the story in one of my books. And the animals came, passage paid, but they didn't actually do what they were intended to do. They were supposed to eat rabbits, and they did eat rabbits, but rabbits can reproduce faster than stoats and weasels can do. Instead, they went for the easier option, which is the native birds, especially the ones that feed on the ground. So it sounded like a good idea at the time, but it didn't actually work out the way people intended it, not unlike various other things that people have tried to do.
Indeed. What would you say over your lifetime's work that we do have a better understanding of what's going on in the forest, that we are doing the right things to try and mitigate?
I would like to think so, but I think probably nature has better ideas, and generally we can't second guess nature. We would like to try to manipulate processes out there according to our own schedules, but often nature will do its own thing anyway.
Well, I hope your book will give people a new understanding of this and also learn about your extraordinary life in devoting your professional time to looking at the lives of these. Yeah, they are fascinating.
The whole thing is summarized in the title. I was totally fascinated all my life by them. They're like any beautiful tool in the hand of an expert. They are superbly adapted for what they do, which isn't what we want them to do. In hindsight, you have to look back and see what happened and thinking, you know, dear me, we made some pretty desperate mistakes there. But that's the way it happens if you don't understand nature. And in the 19th century, we had no chance of doing that anyway.
No. Well, thank you for putting all the work into this book. It is totally fascinating. The book is called Stotally Fascinated. It's a memoir of a lifetime study of weasels and stoats. It's by Carolyn King and published by Quentin Wilson Publishing. And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.